Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Terry Bunn Injury Prevention Show because from the University of Kentucky, we are joined by Associate Professor with the Department of Preventative Medicine and Environmental Health, Director of the Kentucky Injury and Injury Prevention and Research Center, and Director of the Occupational Injury and Illness Surveillance Program, Dr. Terry Bunn. Welcome to the program, Terry.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about the work we do at the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center.
My co-medical host, Rick Phillips, is on sabbatical pending the investigation of why Health Matters can no longer visit the Bouncy House. We'll have more on that at a later show. Our website to listen to our show, wmky.org. For our research, it's HM Radio Show. That's on Facebook. Our sponsor, Shoes with Tread. That's right, Shoes with Tread back. Staying out of the nursing home, you've talked the talk, now walk the walk. Now, according to Dr. Bunn, I'm going to read this quote for you, Terry, from September of 2010. Falls are a leading cause of death among older Kentuckians and are among the most preventable types of injuries. So one of the ways we can prevent them, obviously, shoes with tread. I've got a little bit of information about shoes, Terry, and then I'll ask for your thoughts on it. Shoe features, which have been shown to influence balance, include the heel height, obviously. High heel shoes, bad news. And I will tell you right now, Dr. Bunn is in the studio, and I note she is not wearing stiletto heels. You know, I would have been very disappointed had you come in because that would have really ruined the sponsor. The heel collar height, that is, how much protection does your heel have? And an open heel allows your ankle to wobble more, is more likely to cause problems. And sole thickness and hardness. And that's an interesting one, Terry. I know a lot of research on athletic shoes showed that those more cushioned shoes don't seem to give you a good feel for what you're walking on. Do you have thoughts on the ideal shoe?
It depends on your type of work, but if you're in an industry where you are dealing with either wet or slippery floors, then the primary consideration that you need to have for your shoes is that they have a non-slip tread on them.
Shoes with Tread is very pleased with that statement. I'm sure we will get a bonus payment for that. Just reminding you, our sponsor, Shoes with Tread. Now, again, according to the Injury Prevention Research Center, falls are largely preventable. And there are things such as muscle strength, reactions to medications, reduced visions, chronic health problems, and unsafe home conditions. But it starts with shoes. Make sure that you are wearing safe shoes. And I'll tell you, you know, one of my favorite shoes to trash on this program has always been flip-flops. My wife works at the school system. There was a case of a child who actually had her foot cut by mulch, which penetrated the sole of a flip-flop. A flip-flop is simply not protection for your feet. And if you are in a stumbling situation or a slipping situation, it's liable to make things worse. Our least favorite shoe here at Health Matters, flip-flops. And again, Shoes with Tread, our sponsor for today's program. Now, Terry, I will tell you, and we talked about this a little bit before the show started, I am absolutely fascinated by your biography and by the work that you've done. You are a New York native.
I am from upstate New York.
And upstate is anything but New York City, is the way I've understood it. What's your definition of upstate?
For an upstater, it would probably be from anything from Albany west or north.
So, I mean, and this is a fairly large state. For those of you who have never been to New York, I happen to drive through it once going to Niagara Falls and have been to the city just a couple of times. I am very much a country boy, but still impressed with the state. On to Corning Community College for medical laboratory technology. Tell me what young Terry Bunn was envisioning as her career. How did you start your career?
When I first entered college, I actually wanted to be a physical therapist and then started taking a lot of biology and chemistry courses and realized that what I really wanted to do was look at the testing that goes on in the laboratory. So I switched to the medical laboratory technology program and finished that degree and started looking for a job and actually found a job at Cornell University as a laboratory technician.
And then about 10 years later, a Bachelor of Science degree. I believe you went to Cornell on scholarship and got a Bachelor of Science in animal science?
Yeah. And actually, I completed my bachelor's degree through the employee program there at Cornell. So I actually paid about $20 for my degree for activity fees. Kind of jumping ahead a little bit as to my obtaining the PhD, because in between, my husband is from Peru, and we actually went to Peru and lived there for 4 years. And while I was there, our youngest child was born there. And when I brought him to New York during a visit to my pediatrician up there, they did the routine testing on him. And after I returned to Peru, I actually received a letter in the mail that said that he had a high blood lead level. And it was 19 micrograms per deciliter. The CDC recommends at that time, in the mid-1990s, that it be 10 micrograms per deciliter or less.
So these are Flint, Michigan levels of lead that your son
yes,
had.
Yes. So anyway, they recommended further testing, and it came back at that time, I think it was 12 or 13, but that really spurred my interest in, well, first of all, prevention of the lead exposures. At that time, Peru was using leaded gasoline, and through the smog, we would wake up every morning to a little bit of silt, even on our vehicles. And so the main prevention strategies that I used at that time was just keeping his hands washed all the time so that he was not doing the hand-to-mouth and contaminating himself with the lead dust. So after that, once my husband obtained a job in New York and we transferred back to New York, actually to the town, right into Ithaca at Cornell, I decided to pursue a PhD in that area. So the area was immunology, but it was actually immunotoxicology, so that I could look at the effects of lead exposure on the developing immune system.
Can you imagine for a moment the frustration of a person who is trained in medical laboratory technology, whose own family member needs a laboratory test and can't get it? Apparently, that degree of frustration leads you to get a doctoral degree in immunology and toxicology. Boy, it is odd how a career is launched, isn't it? I mean, obviously, you had an interest in this anyway, but to see your own family involved in something and have to go to extraordinary means to help them, I know that was tough. That had to be tough. Then, and you were an elementary science teacher in Peru.
Yes. Well, I used my training from Cornell with an animal science degree in the science background, and used that to be an elementary science teacher while I was in Peru. So if anything, I'd say that I'm really adaptable to the places that we've lived.
Well, and I have to say, you know, I was watching the progression. Okay, Cornell, Peru. And now I understand with your husband requirement of being down there. And I now see how that redirected your career. You and your husband were comfortably ensconced in the Cornell education system. And then as of May 21st, a postdoctoral associate at Cornell University, these are the jobs that you get as you are looking for those faculty positions in academia and so forth. And then a principal investigator in Kentucky. So talk to me about the move from Cornell to the University of Kentucky.
Well, again, it's a case of adaptability. My husband was transferred to headquarters here in Kentucky. He works for Altec. So when we moved down to Kentucky, our children were fairly small, about 6 and 9 years old, and we did not know anyone here as far as childcare goes. So I did obtain a job at first in a laboratory, an immunology laboratory, and worked there for approximately 3 months, but with running mice and rat experiments, it's not conducive to regular work hours. So I actually had to quit that job and look for other positions at the University of Kentucky. So they had one that was available in the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center looking at occupational safety and health surveillance. So it kind of intrigued me that I had the background in toxicology to look at worker exposures. So those would be workplace exposures. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking chemical exposures, for which I had the background and training in for my PhD. So I actually interviewed for a job there at first as the fatality investigator of worker deaths. And when I talked to the director at that time, he said, well, no, you're overqualified for this position, but with your experience and background, I think you'd be great as the director of the Occupational Safety and Health Surveillance Program. So I pretty much just kind of landed in that position right away with my background looking at exposures, and then extended that to injury prevention, for which I'm really grateful for that opportunity to the former director too, because I've just fell in love with the whole thing of looking at injury and illness surveillance in the state.
You know, interesting enough, accidents and injuries, the fourth leading cause of death in the state of Kentucky and nationwide, but it is an unusual combination of firearms deaths, car crashes and ATV crashes, and poison ingestion and drug overdoses. So this requires a multi-talented person. Obviously, you had very much the skill to understand these chemical exposures, but a bit of on-the-job training, I'm guessing, in terms of car crashes and firearms.
That's right.
And if you can imagine, then, part of the professional development of an injury prevention researcher is not only you've been through suicide prevention programs, defensive driving courses, you've had to learn how semis are constructed and the weak points of construction. This is, I think, what fascinates me is I cannot imagine what your own educational goals for the year would be, because there are so many things that go into accidents and injuries.
Well, first of all, we don't call them accidents in the Kentucky Injury Prevention Research Center. We call them incidents, because we tend to believe that all injury incidents are preventable in some form or fashion.
It's a thing to think about. Just an aside, a personal aside for just a moment. My father fell out of a barn. He was in his 80s. He fell out of a barn. He had this habit. He liked to pick up his own square bales of hay, and as he got older, he made them smaller and smaller and more square, so that there was no way that they would tie together, and they were just a loose jumble of hay cubes, essentially. So he was on the top of that, slipped, and rolled right out of the barn. I said, Dad, you can't do this. He said, well, I guess I've got to be more careful. And I have used those words again and again with my patients. At age 85, you will not suddenly be more careful. You've got to analyze what went wrong with any type of injury, and that obviously is your professional career, and so I apologize for using the term accident. You're absolutely right. Even things that seem to be acts of God, there are things you can do to either reduce the amount of damage and suffering, or perhaps to prevent them altogether. And maybe, and I've got a little bit of time here, I just wanted to very quickly a couple of titles that I highlighted out of your research. You published in 2011, Injuries Among Solid Waste Collectors in the Private versus the Public Sector. You've written a chapter on developmental immunotoxicology. You talked about farmer exposure to organic solvents during the maintenance and repair of farm injury. Numerous things on animal research from early in your career, as well as a book chapter on delayed type hypersensitivity, which is an immune reaction. Taken together, this is a fascinating career with many different facets and, again, ongoing education. I wish we had more time for this, but we've used up our first fractional portion. Please take a break, but stay tuned. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. This is Dr. Tony Weaver, and this is the Dr. Terry Bunn Injury Prevention Show, because from the University of Kentucky, we have obtained a person, again, we'll call her a Health Matters hottie, a Health Matters hero of today's youth, a person who has used her personal life to achieve a position where she can be in position to help a lot of Kentuckians. This is Dr. Terry Bunn, Associate Professor in the Department of Preventive Medicine and Environmental Health, Director of the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center, and you call that KIPRIC, Terry, is that right?
That's right. It's known as KIPRIC.
And also the Director of the Occupational Injury and Illness Surveillance Program. Welcome back to the program, Terry.
Thanks for inviting me.
For the second time, our sponsor, Shoes with Tread, reminding you, you've talked the talk, now walk the walk. Fall prevention. And again, from Dr. Bunn, falls are a leading cause of death among older Kentuckians and are among the most preventable types of injuries. We talked some about shoes with tread in our first fractional portion, and remind you that Dr. Bunn agrees that tread is the single most important part of the shoe. Do you wear leather sole shoes, the slick leather soles, or what are your shoes mostly?
I do not. I actually buy many of my shoes with a slip-resistant treads on them.
I am a running shoe guy myself, but that is one of the things. Heel height is another one. Obviously, high heels create instability. Heel collar height, that is how much protection you've got. And I have my own father, I recommended for him that he go to hiking boots, which would give him more support in his ankle. He was having some difficulty falling. And then sole thickness and hardness as well. And surprisingly, sometimes some of the softer, more padded soles tend to cause you to lose contact, lose the sense of where your foot is, and may actually influence your chances of falling. This was back from 2009, the journal Age and Aging, the effects of footwear on balance amongst elderly women at a day hospital. And they had the women to do some tests barefooted and then wearing footwear, and they found a lower risk of falls, a better balance score when they wore shoes as opposed to when they went barefoot. The problem with this is, as many of us know, many of our elderly relatives, particularly elderly female relatives, spend their day in house shoes or slip-on shoes or even barefoot. I'm in a fight with my daughter right now. She is, many of you know, my oldest daughter has her doctoral degree in marine ecology, and they spend all their time on the beach, and beach people take their shoes off when they come in the house. And I think that's a bad idea. They feel that it's necessary to keep sand out of the off the floor, and we go back and forth. But from a health standpoint, barefoot is not a good idea. That's our sponsor, Shoes with Tread, reminding you, you've walked the walk, you've talked the talk, now walk the walk. Make sure that you keep your balance. So let's talk about Kiprick, Terry. The 20-year anniversary of Kiprick, October 22nd, 2015, was reported by the University of Kentucky. And I'm just going to read what they said, and then I'll ask you to expand on this. It was approved by the University of Kentucky Board of Trustees as a multidisciplinary center, merging academic research and public health outreach efforts to reduce the incidence and prevalence of intentional and unintentional injury and death in Kentucky. Through education, data surveillance, strategic partnerships, health interventions, policy initiatives, and public health programming, research programs address public health issues pertinent to Kentuckians, including drug overdose, motor vehicle safety, pediatric and adolescent injuries, trauma, fire hazards, community safety, and more. So you're talking about everything from overdosing on drugs to trying to make your home safe from fires. This center has a very broad charge.
We sure do. We sure do. Just as you mentioned, we cover everything from violence, including sexual assault, intimate partner violence, to child maltreatment, and then all the way to unintentional injury prevention, including the prevention of motor vehicle injuries and the prevention of drug overdoses, which for the most part are accidental in nature.
You know, I've seen a real change in drug overdoses in my career. When I first started, these were mainly people who intended to end their life, and they usually took some pretty toxic substances, and if they took enough of them, it was a real serious problem. More recently, as, again, narcotics overdoses have risen dramatically, most of the people I see who overdose had no intention of overdosing when they started, but simply they misjudged a combination of medicines or the dose of a medicine and wound up either becoming seriously ill or dying from that. I know that's taking a large part of your time looking at the overdose problem in Kentucky. What are right now the main focus of your research and education efforts from the center? What topics are you really working on mostly at this point?
Okay, well, in the area of drug overdose prevention, we have a current grant that was funded by the CDC, National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, that is a multi-pronged effort. So the first strategy that we are using for drug overdose prevention is looking at enhancing and maximizing the prescription drug monitoring program in Kentucky, which is called CASPER. With the Casper, what we are doing is looking at the integration of Casper data into the electronic health record. So what that means is that when a controlled substance prescriber pulls up the prescription drug monitoring report on a patient to see what controlled substances they've been prescribed, that report will actually come up, we're thinking probably as an icon within the electronic health record so that you don't have to do a separate query to obtain that prescription drug history of the individual. Through that, we have also implemented a 100 milligram morphine equivalent flag into the Casper electronic reports. What that means is there is a little box that comes up in the right-hand corner for those individuals who have 100 milligrams morphine or equivalent, either through multiple prescriptions for opioids. And so that flag will come up to for the controlled substance prescriber that they may want to have increased vigilance of the patient with a high amount that has already been prescribed, and then also that they may want to consider a prescription for naloxone, which is would reverse an opioid overdose.
Now, let me just as a practitioner tell you, if someone comes into my office that I am starting a new prescription, and that prescription is going might last for a while for a narcotic pain medicine, the first thing I have to do is log out of the electronic record, go to the internet, log into this electronic database that the state government runs, and find out how much and who else is prescribing narcotics for this particular patient. What you're saying is that should be, as soon as I think about prescribing a narcotic medicine, that information should come up automatically, you mentioned, as an icon in the electronic record, rather than me having to go to a different site.
Yes. That would be the ultimate outcome, hopefully to increase clinical workflow to help make your job a little bit easier.
Yeah, I will tell you, practicing physicians would thank you if we can integrate that. And then the second thing is actually a check. That is, I can look at this and I can say, oh my goodness, this person is getting narcotics from three different physicians. This person is writing for this dose and this person is writing for that dose. I better rethink my strategy in being the fourth person to prescribe narcotics for this particular person. Now, keep in mind, if they go to get it filled in some states, it won't show up in our record. But we're starting to develop reciprocal relationships with a lot of states that border us, so it's pretty hard now. I feel pretty confident when I query, I'm going to get useful information from our, we call it our Casper system here in Kentucky. But now the other thing is, then I've got to mentally figure out, well, how much is that person taking? And what you're saying is that there will be a new flag that says, oh, you need to watch out. This is approaching the point where it gets really risky for a person dying. If they take their medicines as directed, could get into serious problems with this milligram strength. And that's, you said 100 milligram equivalent of morphine.
Yes, that flag will come up. And actually, it's already been implemented. It was implemented in December 2015.
So again, just trying to make the overall prescription of narcotics safer, understand who's prescribing, how many of these prescriptions are being filled, what the milligram strength is, and rather than having to chase that down, and there's so many things now that the individual practitioners of medicine have to chase down, having that information coming in at the point of care could, you're betting, will save lives. Now, let's go back. We talked about this some, and I know you and I have different impressions of House Bill 1. I'll give you mine first. I'll give you a chance to rebut. House Bill 1, a courageous effort, a well-thought-out effort by the Kentucky legislature. My applause to them for doing this. However, in my mind, did not have the effects they desired. It did curb narcotic prescribing in the state of Kentucky. However, if the job was to save lives, the drug overdose death rates, the total death rates due to narcotics overdoses, in fact, have not changed significantly. Now, you could argue that they haven't risen, but they certainly haven't dropped in a real significant, clinically significant way. The problem was about the time we shut down or reduced our prescription narcotics, heroin became widely available. So now we have drug overdoses with heroin and fentanyl, but also we have the problem of these drugs being injected with dirty needles, and we are seeing an epidemic of hepatitis C, and potentially we could run into an epidemic of HIV/AIDS in rural Kentucky. So I thought this was well-intentioned legislation that was well-crafted, and yet due to unintentional effects, wasn't as effective as they wanted. I am disappointed in it. You feel that it is a part, I know, of a bigger movement against narcotics. And what do you think about House Bill 1?
Well, first of all, House Bill 1 has been effective in reducing prescription drug overdose deaths and the death rate in the state. It has decreased significantly since it was implemented in 2012. And I would say that the rise in heroin would not be a direct consequence or an unintended consequence of House Bill 1, because we are seeing that rise in heroin deaths throughout the United States in those states that also do not have equivalent House Bill 1s in their state. It's just a problem of pretty much supply and demand. Right now, there's a huge demand for low-cost drugs, and to satisfy that, heroin has been made available that's fairly low cost. And recently, we have seen a huge jump, pretty much a 400% increase in the number of drug overdose deaths that are involve fentanyl.
Problem that
and
is,
I should say, I should have expanded on that, that the fentanyl is not prescribed fentanyl, but in fact, we figure less than 5% of those deaths that do involve fentanyl had a legitimate prescription for that fentanyl. So it's fentanyl that's been illicitly obtained or produced.
So, again, there's the two sides of it, I will concede. Definitely, we did lower our prescription drug overdose deaths due to House Bill 1. My concern is possible ripple effects. Your broader picture is that those may not be ripple effects. Those are simply the changing nature of the drug market, and what we would have seen then was possibly a continuing prescription drug overdose added to a new problem with heroin that was going to hit Kentucky anyway. Any way you look at it, this is a very difficult problem to address. I do think, again, I am a frequent critic of our politicians and our legislature, but this bill was nicely done. It was about as strong a bill and as well thought out a bill, I think, as any state legislature in the country did, and hats off to them for that. I wish fewer Kentuckians were dying due to narcotic overdose, and we could find some way to crack through that. So I'm looking at the report that your center puts out annually, and I'm looking at the leading causes of injury-related deaths by age group. And if we start at infants, the number one cause is suffocation. What type of things would cause suffocation among an infant?
Well, it could be, again, I'm not the one that's the direct expert on that. Dr. Susan Pollack, who is the director of our adolescent and pediatric injury prevention program, is. But from conversations with her, a lot of times what is seen is pretty much where the child is put to sleep. So that could be where the sheets are not tight on the crib mattress, or the crib mattress may be too soft, so the child can suffocate in that regard if the child's put on his or her belly as opposed to on their back. So that would probably be the primary way. But again, I would recommend talking to Dr. Susan Pollack about that.
We'll try to get her on the show. I know, again, not an expert, but again, we've changed our recommendations on positioning an infant and sleeping to putting them on the back rather than on the belly. And the other thing is, I know sleeping with parents turns out to be a risk factor as well. Ages 1 to 4, fire and flames. Interesting. I wasn't sure what 1 to 4 would be, but fire and flames and then drowning. And this is really important this summer. We at Health Matters have given you our swimming pool safety tips. Be very cautious. That is the two leading causes of death in children ages 1 to 4. Starting at age 5 and going to 24, it is car crashes, motor vehicle collisions causing death. And then from 25 to age 64, poisoning. And this is, again, drug overdoses, I assume, the lion's share of this.
Yes. It's primarily through drug overdoses.
Between 65 and 75, again, back to motor vehicle crashes. That is interesting. That might, I guess, be the starting of maybe not being your reaction slowing a little bit, or maybe it's just a statistical thing.
Reaction slowing plus as far as your own body goes, being able to resist the force that's within a motor vehicle crash.
you have then in your life, you have reached the ripe old age of 75. You have avoided suffocation, fires, drowning, car crashes, and poisoning, and starting at age 75 and extending for the rest of your life, the chief leading cause of injury-related death is, in fact, falls.
It is.
We see this. A broken hip can be fixed. A broken hip absolutely can be fixed. However, the problem is when you are in your 80s or your early 90s, having that major surgery, you don't necessarily come back from that with your health intact. So, in fact, that broken hip carries the same overall mortality as a heart attack or heart failure, so can be a really serious problem. So those are from the KIPR, from the Injury Prevention Research Center, their annual report. Those are the leading causes of injury death among Kentuckians. Now, I've got a little bit of time this segment, and we got next segment, and I wanted to talk for about a couple of things. One, in the time we got left, texting. I know the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center back about a year ago did publish a press piece about cell phones and about texting. And talk to us a little bit about the problem with texting and also about hands-free, because a lot of us have now voice-activated features on our phones and in our cars.
Yeah, well, there was a study done, I think it was at the University of Virginia Tech, where they found that even the use of hands-free, with that, you were 23 times more likely to be involved in a crash. So there have been a number of studies done in this area, and it pretty much is recommended that if you can, do not use the cell phone at all in your vehicle, whether it's handheld or hands-free.
You know, we've got some more. We'll have some more information on this because I think this is fascinating that we line our interstates with cell towers. We put all these Bluetooth devices in our cars. And the question is, obviously, is where is this all going to lead? Because it doesn't seem to be a very safe thing to do. Meanwhile, why don't you do something safe? Take a break. Be very careful. Come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. I am your host, Dr. Tony Weaver. I am joined at the microphone for this show. This is the Dr. Terry Bunn Injury Prevention Show, because from the University of Kentucky, physicians with the College of Public Health, as well as with the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center, associate professor in the Department of Preventive Medicine and Environmental Health, Dr. Terry Bunn. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And you know, the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center, we talked about the diffuse mission of KIPRIC, but I imagine it took a lot of work to get such a center formed. This is not an obvious responsibility of any particular department or division within a college or a medical school. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center, or KIPRIC as we call it, was established by the Board of Trustees at the University of Kentucky in 1994 as a unique collaboration between the University of Kentucky and the State Department for Public Health. So the majority of the grants that we receive, we are primarily grant-funded, the center is as the bona fide agent for the State Department for Public Health. So we are their injury prevention arm. The State Department for Public Health does not have their own injury prevention entity, and we serve that purpose for them. So we are unique. Actually, we're unique in the country. We are the only center in the country that has this set up. And through this, we get to combine academic research with public health outreach. So, and with that, the implementation of community programs and the informing of policies and programs in the area of injury prevention.
You know, and it's an example then of how academic institutions can partner with other agencies to try to expand the influence they have. Now, if you disagree with the policies, well, then you've got the university and the state government colluding there. But as a person who is interested in protecting public safety and saving lives, I am very grateful that these people were flexible enough to work together, because in the state of Kentucky, Kentucky is an injury-prone state. I mean, we are among the top five, I believe, nationally in injury deaths, aren't we?
Yes, I think we're fifth highest for our fatal injury death in the nation.
Yeah, and I've, again, in my teaching time that I spend with students, I tried to break that down some. And we have, obviously, we know that we're top five for drug overdoses. We're also top five for, I know, ATV accidents. We are one of the top per capita for that. Our roads are not necessarily all that safe. Many of them, we have high accident rates, high injury rates, high crash rates in our rural areas. So when you break down the different parts of injuries, we seem to do poorly pretty much in all of them, I'm thinking. Are there any bright spots in your work where Kentucky actually looks a little safer than other states? So what I've asked her is there anything you don't worry about? And you've got to see the facial contortion she went through trying to think of something she did not worry about. Well, we vaccinate our kids. You know, let's go back. We're a good vaccination state, but I guess in terms of accidents, it's looking pretty bad across the board, huh?
Well, I would like to say, with that said, that we have improved in a number of areas. I mean, we have actually gone from like fifth or fourth highest for our motor vehicle fatality rate, and now we're like seventh highest. So we are improving, and that actually goes for drug overdoses too. We were up to number two there a year or two ago for our drug overdose fatality rate, two or three, and now we are fourth or fifth in the nation. So we are improving in a number of areas.
You know, when you're bottom of the nation, I mean, obviously fourth or fifth, you may shrug at that. But honestly, when you're at the bottom of the nation in so many health indicators, those type of changes, for those of us who have been doing this for a long time, they're very gratifying to get off that lead point where we are number one in the nation. We still have problems with the cancer deaths, particularly with lung cancer death, with respiratory diseases, with all sorts of things. But if we can make any movement at all off the bottom of our nation's rankings, we feel like we are making some progress. So I would wholeheartedly agree with you on that. Our sponsor for the final time is Shoes with Tread, reminding you, you've talked the talk, now walk the walk. We talked about those essential elements of shoes, low heels, and number one for both Dr. Bunn as well as myself is making sure that you have a good gripping tread on that shoe. You do not want slick shoes. If you are like me, if you're as clumsy as I am, you need absolutely no help reaching the floor. I can do that at a moment's notice without any forethought on my part, so I do not need to have extra slick shoes. Remember also that you can stabilize your ankle joint by wearing higher collars around the heel. These would be what we call high top shoes, and I have recommended them for several of my frequent followers. And the soles it's a rather difficult proposition. Softer soles certainly provide more padding, and for a lot of elderly people, they enable them to walk, but they also are associated with a lower sense of perception of whether or not you're on steady ground, and that can be a problem. What's interesting is the more things you do to get an elderly person to walk, the higher their risk of fall. So we found with effective arthritis treatment, with joint replacements and things like that, the more you walk, the more you fall. Don't be discouraged by that. What we have to do, actually, is to provide safe ways to walk. But it is a fact that one in three elderly people over age 65, falls every year. I am not surprised by that. I myself have not reached 65 yet, but I fall pretty much all the time. I have dogs. I have sloping ground in eastern Kentucky. And so I, as I mentioned, I can communicate with the floor with very short notice pretty much any time during the day. That's our sponsor, Shoes with Tread. Remember, check your footwear. It may save your life. Now, we had a discussion going. I'll be polite about this. A discussion going about texting. And I am not I'm not advocating texting while driving. But you can see that this thing is in motion. We set out cell towers all along our highways so that people could use their phones. We have now integrated phones into the car systems to a great degree. We have voice-activated systems so that you don't have to look away. But as Dr. Bunn mentioned last time, that may not be the issue. The issue may be distracting your mind, not necessarily your eyes. We are headed toward driverless cars, although we had our first fatality in a driverless car just this last month nationally. So Terry, looking ahead, your feeling is that where do you think this is going to go based on your research? Do you think that we will see more restrictions on electronic devices, or do you think that we will try to improve our cars to allow for more electronic devices? What do you see from your research on this?
I think you have to achieve a balance, one that's going to improve driving, such as stability control, those types of electronic options that, well, actually are required now, I think, on passenger vehicles for when you're driving on slippery surfaces versus those where you have the GPS, for instance, right maybe in your line of vision. The whole thing is to reduce mental distractions in vehicles.
You know, and I will remind you, about a year ago, the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center issued this press statement: unlike talking and chewing gum, driving and talking on a cell phone are both thinking tasks, and the brain must focus first on one and then the other. There is simply no way around that. You can't think of two things at the same time. And they also mentioned text messaging by voice dictation, still a hazard, still, in fact, maybe by the fact that you have to think through that message as you're talking, may actually be more of a distraction. So from Kiprick, texting any form, whether it is dictated, whether it is by buttons, you should not be doing that while you drive a car.
No, you should not.
Now, I want to go back because I cut Terry off. This was my fault, and I apologize to our radio fans. We were talking about drug overdoses, and you mentioned that there are several activities that Kiprick is involved in to try to mitigate the number of people dying from drug overdoses. I apologize, I'm distracted by more than one task, but we were talking about beefing up the CASPER program, integrating it into the health records, putting flags in when you reach a certain dosage of narcotics. You also talked about naloxone, which is a reversal agent, and we think if we can get that reversal agent out in the public more and out of hospitals and actually out into the community, we may be able to reverse an overdose in time to save a life. Talk to me more about what Kiprick is doing for drug overdoses.
Yeah, well, we've also established a drug overdose fatality surveillance program. What that is comprised of is that we are taking toxicology reports, coroner investigation reports, medical examiner reports, as well as the CASPER prescription history to get a sense of the specific drugs that are contributing to the drug overdose deaths. Through this drug overdose fatality surveillance system, we have seen, well, we caught the sharp increase that's occurring in those drug overdose deaths to fentanyl, but we're also seeing drug overdose deaths that also involve gabapentin.
Gabapentin, Neurontin, a common agent used that to treat diabetic nerve pains, shingles pains, and things like that. It's considered to have a lower risk of side effect. It isn't essentially an anti-seizure medicine, but you're seeing it. I guess one thing is it may tie up your metabolism and increase the levels of other drugs, but it itself, I guess, also might make people more sedated. That surprises me. I know we've had problems with adding Xanax to the mix. Everyone knows you add alcohol to prescription drugs, you get into trouble. I would not have thought Neurontin was that much of a problem, but that's showing up in your data.
It's showing up in the data, and that would not show up in a CASPER report because it's not a controlled substance.
No, it has gained that widespread use because gabapentin or brand name Neurontin was generally felt to be lower in side effects than some of the old seizure medicines like phenobarbital that we used 20 or more years ago. So combined then, you are trying to get more information and more specific information in the hands of the people who prescribe this, as well as trying to get reversal agents in the hands of the people who would be using it or would be first responders.
Yes, but both of those. And we're also trying to identify the specific drugs that are involved in drug overdoses in the state. So as part of this grant, we also have two other strategies. One that's kind of rolled in with the drug overdose fatality surveillance system is we are conducting an evaluation of a law that also passed in 2012 that requires a decedent be tested for controlled substances when no other cause of death has been established. And what we're finding in the preliminary evaluation of that law is that it has been effective in now identifying the specific substances that are involved in drug overdoses. Whereas before, a death might be considered of undetermined nature, now that scene will be tested for controlled substances, and that may also have led to a partial increase in the number of drug overdose deaths that have been seen in the state since 2012 with the passing of this law. So it's not that we are seeing increased drug overdose deaths, but part of it may be due to increased testing for controlled substances.
You know,
I
didn't know that. It makes perfect sense, though. In so many cases, someone dies mysteriously, and you think, "Oh well, you know, sorry about that." But now it is the law that if they die mysteriously, they will be tested.
Yes.
Okay. So again, you will see then. First of all, you get information about what drugs might be causing some of these mysterious deaths. You may get an early indicator that we have a new drug invading Kentucky because people are dying mysteriously. I assume there was some opposition to that. I know as a family member, I may or may not want that information to be collected. But congratulations for getting that passed. The public health benefits from that.
Yeah, well, I have to say it wasn't us that passed it. We helped provide data results for the Office of Drug Control Policy in the state, and the director of the Office of Drug Control Policy with the state medical examiner, they are partners who really sponsored the bill and were able to get that passed. What also as a result of the passage of that law is before a drug overdose death may have only been listed on the death certificate as drug overdose or polydrug toxicity. Now we've seen an increase in the number of death certificates where the specific drugs are listed on the death certificate. So that's providing us with much more information on what is actually causing the drug overdose deaths.
If you don't know why, again, we're looking at 1,000 Kentuckians a year, give or take. And if you don't know why these people are dying, specifically why these people are dying, you really can't help. So this is a very valuable legislation. Again, an example of a collaborative partnership that turns out to benefit people in Kentucky. I am so sorry because we've only got about a minute left. I am fascinated. I just want to comment about your research on semi-trucks and semi-truck fires. You said semi-trucks are much more likely than passenger vehicles to catch fire in a crash.
They are. In the study that we did, we found that semi-trucks have a much higher probability of catching fire in a crash when compared to pickup trucks and passenger vehicles. If you remember, many years ago in the 1970s, the Pinto had problems with catching fire due to rear-end collisions, and that was primarily due to the placement of the fuel tank within the vehicle. We find that when you're looking at semi-trucks, a lot of those fuel tanks, well, most of those fuel tanks actually tend to be placed on the outside of the vehicle as well. So what we have recommended in that study is that manufacturers consider placing those fuel tanks within the vehicle, similar to what had to be done with the Pinto in the 1970s.
From fuel tanks to toxicology to drug overdoses, it is a fascinating job. You are a fascinating person, and I think the Commonwealth benefits from your work. I'd like to thank my guest today, Dr. Terry Bunn, Associate Professor, Department of Preventive Medicine and Environmental Health, and Director of the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center. Special thanks also to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Hunter Reese, our WKY producer and manager, John Amagi, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org. Visit us on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters is the leading cause of death for U.S. residents age 1 to 44, and Health Matters-related motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of major traumatic injury in both Kentucky and the U.S. These injuries oftentimes lead to long-term disability or impairment, but there are programs within the Kentucky Injury Prevention and Research Center to address the burden of Health Matters trauma-related injuries through trauma data collection, workplace injury surveillance, community partnerships, and population-based outreach. The Kentucky Injury and Prevention and Research Center's objective over the next 5 years is to create safe communities throughout the state of Kentucky to cover 50% of the population and to evaluate the effectiveness of the new recruitment approach and its impact on reducing injury injuries, and fatalities. Whatever you do, do not take health matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as we review the U.S. Ophthalmology webpage, A Sight for Sore Eyes, on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.